Hi, I'm Nyla Boodoo, host of Axios Today. It's a daily podcast that gives you the latest scoops and analysis to power your day. But we don't just run through the headlines. We provide the important stories you won't get anywhere else. Everything from politics to space to race and justice. So grab a cup of coffee or a cup of tea for me and join me for 10 minutes every morning to get up to speed for the day ahead. You can listen to Axios Today on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. Meet Wise, one account for over 50 currencies, because today your life is bigger than one currency. Whether you're sending pesos to your parents, receiving dollars from a friend, or spending in euros, you can do it all in one account. With Wise, you can manage your money across borders cheaper, faster, and easier. Join 13 million people and businesses who are already saving, and try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
In Sri Lanka, police crack down on protesters. They say they're not giving up.
The government want to give us fear, but we want democracy. We are not leaving till die.
Also today, Ukraine and Russia reach a deal to restart grain shipments. Good news for Europe, which is dealing with an energy crisis, global food crisis, and potentially another migration crisis.
And having three crises on the table, it's not the best meal.
I'm Jason Margolis, and some of the fastest runners on Earth are gathering in Oregon.
So this final lap, there's some pushing and shoving. Jake Whiteman pushes his way through.
Plus, why many Chinese mortgage holders are saying to the bank, I'm not paying. Those stories and more ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Jason Margolis, in for Marco Werman. Thanks for joining us on this Friday. We begin our coverage today in Sri Lanka. In the capital, Colombo, last night, security forces cleared a protest camp outside of the presidential office. Demonstrators had been there for the past 3 months. They've been demanding new leadership and relief from crippling inflation and shortages of basic necessities like food and fuel. The crackdown on protesters came less than a day into the tenure of Sri Lanka's new president, Ranil Wickremesinghe, and his new government's action is being widely condemned. The World's Carolyn Beeler is at the protest site in Colombo right now. Carolyn, what exactly happened last night?
So at about 2 a.m. this morning, the Sri Lankan military forcibly removed occupying protesters from a portion of their camp in downtown Colombo. Videos show a street full of soldiers marching in riot gear toward the camp, tearing down tents, and sometimes pulling and grabbing people along the street. In this video, you can hear the BBC journalist who shot it repeatedly identifying himself as soldiers approaching him. I just connected with one of the protesters who I talked to yesterday, Chanu Nimecha. She showed me her wounds from being beaten by military members with batons and kind of like a wire switch. She says her tent was torn down around her, and then she was chased through the camp and beaten. Dozens of people were injured, two journalists badly enough to have to go to the hospital, and nine people were arrested.
That is quite a story. Carolyn, who else did you speak with?
I spoke with a protester called Budika Abhiraithna, who was here last night, and he told me what he saw.
Last night, our government troops, they came to beat us. Six soldiers beating the one person.
You saw six soldiers beating one person?
Yeah.
So I understand that the protesters had decided they were going to clear out of this area by 2 p.m. today.
Yeah.
Why do you think the crackdown came just, you know, hours before that?
The government want to give us fear, but we don't fear. We want democracy. We are not leaving till die. They can kill, no matter.
Wow, that's pretty deep stuff. Carolyn, you're at the protest site right now. What's the scene like today?
So the main road here has been barricaded, and there are maybe 100 police officers and members of the military behind that barricade guarding the road that leads past the president's office. The tents that used to be behind that barricade are now gone. They've been torn down. But if I turn around, I can see that most of the rest of the protest camp here is still standing. When I came down here around dawn, it was pretty quiet. Now it's lively again. There are people here. The people that I've been talking to here are angry. They're frustrated about the tactics of the new president, but they were expecting this, and they say they're not leaving.
බඩගින්න පිළිබඳ ප්‍රශ්නයක් මේක. ඒ නිසා මේ මේ ෆයිට් එක කොහොමද ඉස්සරහට යනවා.
This is a Buddhist monk and protester named Tempidiya Sugatanada saying, quote, "The struggle is about daily life here, so we're not going to stop because of one crackdown."
So in the aftermath of last night's violence, what's happening today with the protest movement?
Lawyers are bailing out protesters at a police station nearby, and demonstrators gathered outside the main train station here in Colombo, less than a mile away from here, calling the president barbaric. They called for the protesters to be released from jail and chanted in Sinhalese, "You can beat us and throw us in prison, but we will never stop until we achieve victory." The demonstrators eventually marched toward here, the barricaded area, and they clashed with military again in the streets.
A lot of determination. What's the government saying about why they're using force against the protesters?
So there was no public comment or statement from the government throughout the day. President Ranil Wickremesinghe last week declared a state of emergency throughout the country, which gave him the power to deploy the military on the streets. He also said in an interview on Wednesday, the day he was elected president, quote, "Occupying the president's office and the prime minister's office under the guise of engaging in a people's struggle is illegal. Legal action will be taken against such people." So kind of foreshadowing what ended up happening last night. There's been widespread condemnation of the attacks from people like the U.S. ambassador to Sri Lanka, Amnesty International, and the leader of the opposition here. He called the crackdown a useless display of ego and brute force.
The World's Carolyn Beeler is in Colombo, Sri Lanka. Carolyn, get some rest, and we'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good, Jason.
Russia and Ukraine signed an agreement today to unblock grain that's been stuck in Ukraine's Black Sea ports for months now. Russian warships have been blockading the ports. Ukrainian mines have also hampered access. Ukraine is one of the planet's largest grain exporters. So when the war started, the United Nations warned that cutting off shipments could create a global food crisis unseen since World War II. But with help brokered by Turkey and the United Nations, grain shipments can now proceed again. To tell us more about today's deal is Stanislav Gorbachev. He's worked in Ukrainian grain exports for 10 years, most recently for the Soufflet Group in France. Just before the war began, he returned to Ukraine to work for an American exporter there. Stanislav, just the basics here first. I know the technical details are still being worked out, but what is this deal supposed to do as far as you know?
This deal is supposed to prevent the global crisis, food crisis. And this crisis would mainly concern the African and developing countries, because if they wouldn't be able to afford the nutrition, therefore they will start to immigrate. They will probably go to EU or other developed countries. I believe this is a great step in terms of humanity and preserving some sort of stable world, if we can say that.
Right. So great step forward. But do you think that ships, whether they're Turkish ships or Ukrainian ships, are going to be willing to come into port to take that grain back out, or is it still too risky?
That's a great question, to be honest. I'm not a military expert. I can say that there is still mines drifting in the Black Sea, and it all depends on the insurance coverage, which I believe would be a great deal of discussion. But I believe that Turkish ships would come and Ukrainian ship owners will allow operations in the Black Sea region as well.
How is the process supposed to work? Will these ships be inspected so that we are sure that grain is going out and not weapons coming in?
Yes, basically it's going to be inspected by all parties. It was the major concern of Russia. Basically, they will try to look at the cargoes when the ships will come to Ukraine. They would look it on the neutral territory.
I see.
The Ukrainian government haven't allowed, obviously, for Russians to look at the Ukrainian cargoes at the ports, but we said that it's not going to be the case. So the headquarters is going to be established in Turkey, we already know that, and it's going to be with the United Nations and all other parties involved.
Yeah. These negotiations have been going on for a long time now. How surprised are you that it seems to have worked out?
I'm not surprised at all. I believe that this agreement is mostly concerned Europe because they're facing energy crisis. they're going to face food crisis if they're not going to have enough food. People from the developing countries, they might start immigrating, and they will most probably immigrate to the developed countries, which is located in EU. And having three crises on the table, it's not the best meal.
So you're kind of saying that the pressure on Russia to make a deal was so high that this deal was sort of inevitable. During the 120-day trial run on this deal, is there anything you are worried about?
The main concern that we have is that Russia might launch their rockets to our ports, or what they will try to do. This is still a mystery for us.
Stanislav Gorbachev has worked in Ukrainian grain exports for 10 years, most recently for the Soufflet Group in France. A week before war broke out, he returned to Ukraine to work for an American exporter there. Stanislav, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Spain's biggest hit this summer is a song that has yet to be released, sung by an artist who's often mistaken for someone she's not. It sounds obscure, but we're talking about the megastar, Rosalía. From Barcelona, Jerry Haddon reports.
The real kicker about Rosalía's summer hit surprise, it's just a fragment of a tune, a tease. Yo decidí que esta noche se sale con tu amimoto, mami. The Instagram clip lasts just 43 seconds. In it, Rosalía's filming herself, jumping around on a bed like a teenager who can't wait to hit the dance floor. The tune and her attitude are pretty infectious. And here on the beach in Barcelona, it's really hot, and even at sundown, the place is jammed. Among the multitudes, Mimi Granet and Carlota Ibar, two local college students. When I mention the name of the new song, Despacha, they seem puzzled, but when I play it... I know that tune, says Ibar, starting to sing along.
So, yeah, it's very catchy, and the melody is also, like, it stays in your head for a long time. Yeah. So you can stop singing.
Yeah, like, it's the kind of song that you would listen with your friends when you go to, like, get some drinks or just, like, to hang out.
Rosalía is, of course, already huge. Her 2018 album, El Mal Querer, wove traditional flamenco hand clapping with techno loops and rap. It earned her top awards at the MTV Music Awards.
I'm so happy to be here representing where I come from and representing my culture.
Her culture. Like with her songs, there's a lot of fusion happening. See, that award that Rosalía won, it was for Best Latina Artist. But Rosalía is from here, a sleepy village outside Barcelona called San Esteban de Ses Rovires, where, it's safe to say, she's well-loved. I'm so proud of her, says Mireia Ventura, the owner of a bar on the town square. I've known her since she was a toddler. She went to school with my son, she says. She was such a nice, caring kid. Serving beers at the bar is 18-year-old Mayor Castro. He's originally from Venezuela, been here for 2 years. When I arrived, he says, and they told me that Rosalía was from here, I was shocked. I assume she was Latina, he says, maybe from Colombia. Coaltura. Coaltura. Latinos, by definition, are from Latin America. In this hit song called Con Altura, Rosalía singing along to a reggaeton beat, about as Latino as you can get. A couple of years ago, Rosalía tried to explain it all to Billboard magazine.
But I've been studying flamenco, and I saw that flamenco has a Colombiana style, Guajira style, Rumba style. And this is so connected to Latin America, you know, and that's crazy, and that blew my mind. And when I went to Panama or when I went to Mexico, I feel like I'm at home. So, yeah, I feel Latina.
But some Latinos say it's not about your feelings, but where you're from. Rosalía knows the distinction. She's become known for her flamenco, which is from the other side of Spain. But by and large, people seem to give Rosalía a pass. Another immigrant here in her hometown, a Bolivian programmer named Fernando Orellano, just laughs it all off.
Sí. Tendrá algo, ¿no? No sé. Bueno, pero también porque
there must be something Latina about her, he says. It could just be because she's Spanish, given the connections between Spain and Latin America. Those connections are historical, linguistic, and, yes, cultural. This summer, they've come together in a dance song, soon to be released, but already a hit. For the world, I'm Jerry Haddon, San Esteban de Ses Rovires.
For more of this summer's global hits, we have a Songs of Summer Spotify playlist for you. The link is on our Twitter feed. We are at The World. I'm Jason Margolis. This is The World. For many years, the property market in China was booming. But there are more signs of trouble ahead. Chinese homebuyers are refusing to pay their mortgages on unfinished apartments. This comes as property developers in China are already facing a cash crunch. Today, China's government announced it would help developers finish stalled projects by providing active credit support. Joining us to help understand all of this is Logan Wright. He's director of China Markets Research with Rhodium Group. He spent the past two decades in China and Hong Kong. Logan, first, what does active credit support mean, and how exactly is the Chinese government going to help real estate developers get out of this mess?
It's not obvious exactly what it means so far. Most of these support efforts seem to be organized by local governments at this stage, and local governments are not in a great fiscal position in order to be able to help property developers, depending upon the scale of the problem.
And just to clarify, people in China buy mortgages on unbuilt properties. That's pretty different than the system we know in the U.S. Why does China do it this way?
This has been beneficial for developers, obviously. And because there's been such strong housing demand from investors in the past, if you do want to move into a house right away, there's plenty of supply out there in that respect as well. But it's not necessarily the newest supply. So people who think that prices will continue to go up often are buying from prior to actual construction being complete. And that creates a huge imbalance because essentially developers have started using the sales revenues from new sales in order to complete properties in older sales. And we're seeing some of the difficulties that developers are now having in order to complete units that homebuyers have already been promised. And those homebuyers are the ones that are now talking about not paying their mortgages on some of these projects.
So if people are talking about no longer paying their mortgage, well, if I do that here in the United States, it's pretty simple. The bank takes my home. Won't Chinese investors lose the equity they've built up in these properties, even if they're not fully built?
Certainly that would happen if they actually walked away. And that's why, this really may be a threat to try to incentivize developers to finish construction. The concern that the homebuyers have, I think, is that many of the property developers have started to default on their bonds and their loans, and they might not be around in order to finish the projects. And that's a legitimate fear.
So let's go big picture here. How much trouble is the real estate sector in China in right now?
It's a very significant downturn that we're seeing right now. COVID restrictions and China's zero COVID policy have amplified the stress, but they didn't really start it. These are imbalances between too much supply, too much construction, and not enough actual fundamental demand. So regardless of what started it, there was always going to be an adjustment in the real estate market in China, and construction was going to slow. Most estimates place the property sector at around 20 to 25% of the economy. Right now, it looks like construction and sales activity is declining somewhere between 20 and 30%. It likely means that overall investment growth in the economy is going to be negative for the full year, which means that overall growth reported at only 0.4% in the second quarter. There's really strong reasons to expect that overall growth could remain in that range as long as the property sector continues to be a meaningful drag on the economy.
So going back to the moves China is making today, that it's going to provide, again, quote, active credit support, you're skeptical that it'll do much. What can Beijing or local governments do to try and to ease some of these fears for people who hold these mortgages or people who are building homes?
There is a lot of capacity where you can instruct policy banks, specific state-directed lenders to provide loans to individual projects if you know that it's distressed. But that can quickly lead to a bailout of the entire sector. And Beijing really does want to avoid that. If they just sort of make an announcement that says that we're going to help property developers in distress, that's going to be a significant proportion of the industry. And you'll all of a sudden have, quite a sizable bailout package on your hands. So hence, this is why you have sort of the outsourcing of this to local governments trying to push this a bit down the chain a little bit and to try to assess where the true scale of the problem is before there's a more considerable response.
Logan Wright is the director of China Markets Research with Rhodium Group. Logan, thank you for explaining this rather complex topic to us.
Thank you, Jason. Appreciate it.
The French are serious about their charcuterie, or cured meats, but last week the country's food watchdog came out with some worrisome news, confirming a link between colon cancer and some of the ingredients used to preserve these meats. Reporter Rebecca Rosman spoke with French butchers and consumers to hear how they're coping.
Multitasking butcher Quentin Grimbert carefully dissects a giant piece of beef as he points to a bright display shelf showcasing his shop's selection of charcuterie.
Derrière nous, on a du jambon cru, jambon blanc.
There's jambon cru, saucisson by the slice, and the most popular item, jambon blanc, a staple used for sandwiches and apéritif. Grimbert goes through two of these hams a week, he says, more than 15 pounds. I'm the one who delivers him the bad news about the link between the preservatives used in cured meats and the risk of colorectal cancer, which kills around 18,000 people a year in France.
So, higher the exposure of the consumer to nitrites and nitrates, the higher the risk of colorectal cancer.
Laurent Guillier is a researcher with the National Food Watchdog, known as ANSES. He says some nitrates and nitrites are necessary in processed meats because they limit growth of bacteria like salmonella, but...
people should limit their consumption of processed meat below 150 grams per week.
Or about 5 ounces. French lawmakers say they're also working on a new bill that would reduce the use of preservatives in cured meats. But butcher Vincent Dignot says French charcuterie makers like him have already been changing their methods.
Après, voilà, nous on travaille sans sel nitrité.
Dignot makes all his charcuterie in-house without any nitrates or nitrites. The trick, however, is getting consumers to understand that no preservatives mean their ham is going to have a shorter shelf life and will have a grayer color as opposed to the bright pink hues they're used to.
No, it's just a color.
In the charcuterie aisle of this supermarket, shopper Celia Scott is buying speck, a popular type of dried pork belly, for her husband. She says the ANSI study should be a wake-up call to French consumers who should accept the gray color of nitrite and nitrite-less ham.
When we see it, it's a bit like if it was like out of date. That's the image it brings to our brain, I think. This is stupid. We just have to change that. What we see is not what we eat.
Larger manufacturers are catching on, too. Here in the supermarket, there's a big variety available. But butcher Quentin Grimbert says while he's all for the idea of using less preservatives in cured meats, there's also something to be said for keeping traditions alive.
C'est important parce que c'est un savoir-faire. Enfin, on le fait
charcuterie making is a savoir-faire industry in France, he says. Every region has its own specialties, and he's proud of the fact that France is one of the few countries that takes this tradition of cured meats so seriously. Some recipes will always have preservatives, he says. It may just mean consumers will have to keep it as an occasional indulgence. For The World, Rebecca Rossman, Paris.
You're listening to The World. Brazil's President Jair Bolsonaro is giving more access to Christian missionaries to contact isolated indigenous tribes.
Na verdade, o Bolsonaro, ele tem
indigenous leaders say they don't like the idea. They want to be left alone to maintain their way of life and protect their lands. That's ahead on The World. I'm Jason Margolis, in for Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Protesters in Baghdad turned out by the hundreds yesterday for a demonstration outside of the Turkish embassy. This followed an artillery strike on a resort town in Iraq's northern Kurdistan region on Wednesday. At least 8 Iraqis were killed and more than a dozen people were wounded. Iraq's government is blaming Turkey. Turkey is pointing the finger at the PKK, a Kurdish group that it considers to be a terrorist organization. Joining us now from Baghdad is Marcin Alshamari. She's a research fellow with Harvard University's Middle East Initiative at the Kennedy School. Marcin, tell us, what do we know about what happened with the artillery strike on Wednesday?
What we do know is that the people who were killed in this strike were Arab tourists to northern Iraq, the Kurdish areas, And one of the reasons that it actually attracted a lot of attention is because they were Arab, and majority of Iraqis are Arab Shian. So it resonated a lot with Iraqis that their co-ethnics had been killed. This is pretty sad because we've seen a lot of killing of other Iraqis, Yazidis, Assyrians, Kurds, and it didn't elicit this level of popular protest or condemnation of Turkey.
So really resonating in Iraq and in Baghdad, where you are right now. We've seen protests this week. What are Iraqis saying to you about this attack?
Well, there's an appetite for boycott against Turkey that I've never seen in Iraq before. And keep in mind, Turkey is a big exporter of goods into Iraq. If you go into an Iraqi grocery store, there's so many Turkish goods. Iraqis are actually the second largest foreign homeowners of property in Turkey. So they're big consumers of Turkish goods. They go to Turkey for vacation a lot. So you can imagine what kind of anger would propel a population that has such strong ties to a country to suddenly say, no, we are boycotting them. So it's very much an astounding degree of public anger.
Right. So that's the situation on the ground. What about the official response from Iraq's government? Besides just condemning the attack, are there ways that Baghdad could respond?
Keep in mind that where we are in Iraq right now is we had elections in October. It's been 10 months without a government. And this really weakens the ability for a unified response, but it also incentivizes individual responses in order to curry public favor. So the foreign ministry has condemned the attack, has said that Turkey is responsible for it. Different politicians have come out and said the same thing. Prime Minister Kalami has come out and condemned it. One of the bigger political parties in Iraq, Fatah, has. The prime minister of the Kurdistan region has. So there's a lot of individual political condemnation of what happened, as well as the official response from the foreign ministry. In the past, you would see a response from Baghdad about this, but this time it seems to be very quick. In a way, it is the first of its kind in this level of condemnation. But they are crippled by the fact that we don't have a government except for the caretaker one, which is limited in its ability to respond.
And what about Turkey? Turkey is denying responsibility for the civilian deaths on Wednesday, and they're blaming the PKK. Is there any veracity to that? Is there any way to back that up?
I mean, this is hardly surprising. Turkey consistently has blamed the PKK, saying that they're using people as human shields or saying that they were the ones who are responsible in previous attacks. This has always been the rhetoric. But what's interesting is that the international community, you know, different countries, as well as the UN presence in Iraq, has condemned what happened, but hasn't really pinpointed who did it. So no finger pointed at Turkey from the international community, only from Iraq.
What about Washington? Has Washington said anything or responded to the attack?
The U.S. ambassador, who is actually new to Baghdad, so she's been here a few weeks, tweeted in Arabic and in English about what happened and condemning it, but not really pointing the finger at Turkey or even mentioning any country by name. So similar to the general international response.
Marcin Al-Shumari is a research fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School's Middle East Initiative. She joined us from Iraq's capital, Baghdad. Marcin, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
On July 25th of last year, just about 1 year ago, the president of Tunisia, Kais Saied, dissolved parliament and monopolized power. Saied has now drafted a new constitution for Tunisia, and once again, on July 25th, Tunisians will vote on whether to approve it. This constitution would change Tunisia into a presidential regime, where the leader holds many powers without any possibility of impeachment. As Lilia Blaise reports from the capital, Tunis, social class and where people live are dividing lines for Tunisians on how to cast their vote in the upcoming referendum.
Sidi Bouzid is the town in central Tunisia where street vendor Mohamed Bouazizi set himself on fire in 2011, prompting the Arab Spring, a series of revolts across North Africa and the Middle East. Today, people are gathered at an outdoor cafe, children are playing and swimming in a pool to escape the heat, while adults discuss the new constitution project. I meet with Samia Nasri. She is 43, has a college degree, and is a housewife, not by choice, but because she could not find work. I ask her if she's optimistic about the upcoming referendum. She says, hopefully I will go and vote. I vote to get finally my right to have a job. I voted for Kais Saied, she says. I trust him. I voted for him because he is a man of law, and I'm always for the rule of law. Like Nasri, many Tunisians believe the referendum will improve their living conditions. Most are hoping for a real change. A few kilometers away from Sidi Bouzid is a mining region called Gafsa. Supporters of the president are distributing leaflets at a market. Amira does not want to give her last name. Like many other supporters of Kais Saied, she is cautious. She is unemployed and a volunteer in the Yes campaign. We are trying to encourage people to participate in this referendum, whether they vote with a yes or no, she says. What matters is that they participate and validate the democratic process. Amira's friend, Mouna, is 38 and also unemployed. She says that she wants people to remain aware. I trust the president, she says, but there is no such thing as a 1,000-person trust. We will be always monitoring him. We are volunteering here, making flyers, with our own money for him. So yes, we support him, we approve of the new constitution, but if something feels shady or is unacceptable, we are going to react. Most of the shoppers and vendors here at the souk are welcoming the supporters of the president. But some of them are still reluctant to vote. Hussein is selling vegetables. I have no idea of the constitution, he says. Wait until I read the constitution first, so we can find out what it's all about. I'm not interested into politics. They have disappointed me too much. But like many Tunisians in the souk, Hussein says he trusts President Kais Saied. I voted for him in 2019 and he has my complete trust, so I still hope that things will change for the best with him. Back in Tunis, many of the elites are against the constitution because they consider the whole process illegal and biased. Elites here are the jurists, policymakers, human rights defenders, unions, a whole spectrum of the intellectual and political class. Political analyst Hatem Rad explains to me the problem they have with the new constitution.
Il a mis un système présidentiel, et quel système présidentiel?
Kais Saied reinforces the powers of the president with a presidential system, he says, and the usual separation of powers is not balanced anymore. The legislative branch and the judiciary are reduced to functions only to serve the executive power, who is the president. Indeed, in the new text, the president has a lot of powers and decides the general politics of the country with the government he appoints. This is a radical break from the semi-parliamentary system which prevailed in Tunisia after the revolution. Besides, the problem of granting full power to the president with no possibility of impeachment, Hatem Rad questions the legitimacy of the new constitution. A constitution has to establish a frame of freedoms, he says, but it also has to come from legitimacy, he adds. The way the text was written is not very legitimate because it was made during an exceptional time with unilateral authoritarian decisions emanating from the president. With so much at stake, it is difficult to know how many Tunisians are going to go and vote. The Liberal Party, AFEC Tunis, is among the few calling for people to vote no. At the party headquarters in Tunis, the president Fadel Abdelkefi explains what might happen if turnout is low. Even if it is 10 people who vote yes, he says, it will be considered a success. So that is why we chose to vote no instead of boycotting, to express our choice, he says. In this tense political climate, Tunisian democracy is put to the test. The voting centers will open at 6 a.m. in the morning and close at 10 p.m., a long day to make one's decision. For The World, I'm Lilia Blaise in Tunis.
Eugene, Oregon is where a lot of the world's top track and field athletes are gathered right now. They're taking part in the World Athletics Championships. The world's Bianca Hillier covers sports for us and has been following all the action in Eugene. Hey, Bianca.
Hey, Jason.
Excited to talk sports with you on a Friday. So right off the bat, it's been 3 years since the last track and field World Championships. I imagine people are pretty excited about that, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Olympics were just a year ago in Tokyo. But remember, there were no fans in the stands then. And it's also the first time the meet has ever been in the U.S. So, yeah, a lot of competition and fanfare out in Eugene.
What a great spot for this event. Of course, Eugene has been on the global track and field map for decades. It's the home of legendary long-distance runner Prefontaine. It's where Nike got its start, outfitting those athletes in the 70s.
Right.
But anyway, I digress. What are the highlights with this year's event so far?
We have to start with arguably the most iconic and popular event in track and field, the 100-meter dash, of course.
Right.
Back in Tokyo, Jamaica swept the podium in the women's race, so the big question this week was, can they do it again? Back-to-back sweeps. And let me tell you, Jason, they made it look easy.
And it's again a Jamaican 1-2-3.
35-year-old Shelly-Ann Fraser-Price led Jamaica's sweep with the gold. I could say the term GOAT a lot in this conversation, you know, greatest of all time, but Shelly-Ann Fraser-Price is the real deal.
Wow. What other countries are coming out on top?
The U.S. does have the most medals by a long shot at this point, but Ethiopia is in second place in the medal count, and their skills really lie in the distance races, as they have for decades, especially the marathon.
Gold medalist today on the streets of Eugene, he is world champion Tamarat Tola. What a run!
Tamarat Tola and Mosinet Geremu took gold and silver in the men's race, and just the next day, their teammate Gadadim Gebreselassie made an Ethiopian sweep. It was a really exciting race.
Great. So those are the runners, and I do enjoy watching the field events as well. What's happening there?
Oh, so much is happening. It's hard not to talk about Venezuela's Yulimar Rojas. She's the Olympic champ and world record holder in the triple jump at just 26 years old. She absolutely electrified the field this week. She always starts by getting the crowd going, and then she bounces down the runway, grabbing gold for Venezuela and celebrating accordingly. Another GOAT, I gotta say.
Greatest of all time. So, Bianca, these kinds of competitions, of course, always bring some kind of upsets. Who has fallen victim to that this year?
The biggest one has got to be in the men's 1500-meter race. Norway's Jakob Ingebrigtsen was far and away the favorite to win, and he was leading for the better part of the race.
The gold medalist from Tokyo leads the way, the 21-year-old Norwegian Jakob Ingebrigtsen.
But with just half a lap to go, Great Britain's Jake Whiteman quickly skirted around him and took off on the straightaway.
It's Great Britain against Norway! Jake Whiteman is about to cause a massive upset, and he
Look, I've watched this race probably 10 times at this point, and the ending never gets old. Whiteman is totally shocked that he won. I mean, his hands immediately go to his head, and he's like, what? Are you serious? And to top it off, his dad was actually in the stadium as a commentator calling the race.
Well, great for him. Sorry for the Norwegian runner. Anybody else who's caught your eye this week?
Yeah, I was really interested in seeing Caster Semenya back on the track in her first world championship since 2017. The gold medalist from South Africa has been banned from running all international events from the 400 meters to the mile because she has naturally high levels of testosterone. Race officials want her to take medication to lower those levels, which she isn't willing to do. So she's had to totally change her training from the 800 meters to the 5,000 meters. Race, which is outside of that range of banned events. She got considerable applause when she was both introduced at the starting line and when she finished the race. Semenya did not advance to the finals, so we won't be seeing her back on the track this weekend.
So the competition ends on Sunday. What are you paying attention to, Bianca, in the final days?
Everyone is going to be watching the women's 800-meter finals. Athing Mo for Team USA, you'll probably remember that name from Tokyo. She won two golds, and she has two national titles, all at the age of 20.
Wow.
The whole track and field universe will be watching on Sunday to see if she can do it again.
Amazing. The World's Bianca Hillier covers sports for us. She's been filling us in on the World Athletics Championships in Eugene, Oregon. Bianca, thanks so much for this.
Of course. Thank you, Jason.
Dutch art detective Arthur Brand is known as the Indiana Jones of the art world. He described a day in the life in an interview with Insider.com.
I have to deal with mobsters, with narcos, with terrorists.
Mobsters, narcos, and terrorists. He's even dealt with pits full of writhing snakes. No, the Indiana Jones analogy doesn't extend quite that far. Brand's latest case was a lot tamer than tracking down the Ark of the Covenant from Nazis. It involved answering the doorbell. In June, a copper reliquary, that's a vessel for holy relics, was stolen from an abbey in Normandy, France. It's said to contain the blood of Christ inside, but the thieves had a hard time selling the thing, so they gave it to a friend. The friend didn't know what to do with it, so he sent it to Brand in a cardboard box that arrived on his doorstep. Brand showed it off to his followers on Instagram.
Now I'm going to show you the two tubes with the blood of Jesus. Here they are.
Authorities are now working to get the reliquary back to the abbey. Lucky for Brand, he said it was stressful having the thing around. He told the Washington Post that he wouldn't curse around it. He also had to remember to wrap a towel around his waist every time he got out of the shower. Being naked in front of a holy relic is apparently a no-no. Turns out, even a real-life Indiana Jones is kind of modest. Earlier this month, a Supreme Court justice in Brazil ordered the government of President Jair Bolsonaro to do more to protect the lives and territory of the Povos Isolados. In Portuguese, that's what the isolated tribes of Brazil are called. It's hard to say exactly how large this population is, but they number in the thousands. And there are about 100 distinct tribes scattered throughout Brazil's Amazon region. For outsiders, contacting these people directly is against the law. That's because they're vulnerable to ailments like colds and the flu. It's also about respecting their desire to preserve their way of life. Still, this hasn't stopped some Christian missionaries. For the final story in our week-long series about religion and nationalism in Brazil, we look at how President Bolsonaro has helped open the door to evangelical missionaries trying to reach out to this isolated population. Michael Fox has the story.
When I ask indigenous leader André Baniwa how many religious missionaries are operating in native territories of the Rio Negro in northwestern Brazil, where he's from, here's his response. I think there are so many groups, even God is confused, he says. The first missionaries were Americans, he says. They arrived to indigenous communities there in the 1940s. Some of Baniwa's family members are Catholic, others are evangelical. He calls himself intercultural. We are nothing without our culture, says Baniwa. Without our culture, we have no knowledge of our traditional medicine and how to care for our natural resources. His people, the Baniwa, have found a way to tread the sometimes complicated line between embracing Jesus Christ and preserving their indigenous beliefs and culture. That's not always easy, but it's something native communities have had to do for centuries. Alongside the Portuguese and Spanish conquistadors came Catholic missionaries seeking to convert indigenous peoples to Christianity. Evangelical missionaries are still at it today. Ethnos 360 is one of the most active groups.
2 billion. That's the number of people in the world right now who have never heard the name of Jesus.
That's a video from the YouTube page of Ethnos 360. That's a Florida-based evangelical group formerly known as New Tribes Mission. It trains missionaries to spread the gospel to indigenous people, and in particular, those who have never heard about Christianity. According to the website, the group has 3,000 missionaries around the world and training programs in more than a dozen countries. It caused a stir in early 2020 when it raised $2 million to buy a helicopter to increase access to native peoples in remote regions of Brazil. President Jair Bolsonaro has supported this work. Around the same time, Bolsonaro appointed an evangelical pastor and missionary, Ricardo Lopez Diaz, to oversee the country's Department of Isolated and Recently Contacted Tribes. Diaz had worked as a missionary with New Tribes Brazil for a decade. Aparecida Vilaça is an anthropologist and the author of a book about missionaries in Brazil. Diaz said they were going to bring the communities resources, help them out, bring medicine, says Vilaça. But the state strategy has been to maintain their isolation. They're voluntarily isolated, and entering their territory is prohibited. Indigenous leaders fought the appointment of Ricardo López Díaz, and they won. He was removed less than a year later following a court order. It's difficult to know exactly how much Díaz achieved at his post, because he served during the first 8 months of the pandemic, when outside individuals were themselves barred from entering into indigenous territories. But his appointment is a sign of how Bolsonaro has embraced the evangelical cause.
Espero que este sonho, pelas mãos do Bento e pelos votos parlamentares, se concretize.
The president's interest in indigenous territories is also about mining. That's him in early 2020 presenting a new bill to Congress aimed at opening access to new mining territories in indigenous areas. Rodrigo Toniol is an anthropologist at the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro.
No governo Bolsonaro, a Amazônia foi isso, é a grande arca do tesouro do Brasil.
For Bolsonaro, the Amazon is a great treasure chest, but there are Indians in the way, says Toniol. The arrival of evangelicals to indigenous territories is part of a process that's far beyond just converting them. For Bolsonaro, it's not about saving souls. But Bolsonaro has been increasingly vocal about the plight of Brazil's native peoples. On numerous occasions over the last 2 years, he's met with indigenous communities that are receptive to his call to open up the region to development. The Indians want to work, he told cameras last August, while wearing a colorful feather headdress and a bow and arrow slung over his shoulder. They want the internet. They want to pay taxes, and we should give them freedom to work, to produce, to integrate themselves into Brazilian society, he said. That position is 180 degrees from the state policies that guided Brazil's indigenous affairs for the last 3 decades. They defended indigenous peoples' right to remain on their land. Antenor Faz is a former longtime employee of Brazil's indigenous agency FUNAI, where he also oversaw the Department of Recently Contacted People.
Exato. Na verdade, o governo Bolsonaro ressuscitou a ideia.
He says the Bolsonaro government resuscitated this idea that had existed in the 16th century to integrate Indians into Brazilian society. Christian missionaries have played a useful role. Anthropologist Aparecida Vilaça says the missionaries have a clear sense of what they're doing. They believe they're doing God's work.
Eles vão para salvar.
These missionaries go to the communities to save souls, she says, because they believe that all of the people of the world need to be touched for the second coming of Christ. But, she says, the missionaries also act as a type of front line. With them, indigenous peoples begin to change their worldview. They're more willing to let go of part of their lands, to make alliances with whites, which is everything that this government wants, she says. And that's native lands and the minerals beneath them. Many indigenous groups, though, say they're not going to let this happen. Native peoples have been some of Bolsonaro's most outspoken opponents. This video shared over social media in April was one of countless indigenous protests against the president in recent years.
Na verdade, o Bolsonaro, ele tem uma vontade no pensamento dele de...
It's clear that Bolsonaro's goal is to do away with us and leave no trace, indigenous leader André Baniwa tells me. Fortunately, he's not going to be able to do it. Despite support from a majority of evangelicals, Bolsonaro trails in the polls ahead of this October's presidential election. But with or without Bolsonaro, the evangelical missions will likely continue, and many communities like the Baniwa will keep walking the tightrope between embracing Christianity and preserving their own indigenous culture. For The World, I'm Michael Fox.
That story is part of our ongoing reporting project, Sacred Nation, about the intersection of religion and nationalism across the globe. Check it out at theworld.org/sacrednation. And that will do it for us today. The World comes to you every weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Jason Margolis. Have a great weekend. Marco Werman is back with you on Monday.